Thank you for coming today. The title of the class is obviously very different than what I usually do in here. Year after year, I've been in here, a long time. I'm sorry you came yesterday and I wasn't here. My mother fell in love with colors and it was just such that I couldn't get away yesterday. Landed in LA just as this class was supposed to be happening. Thank you for coming today. I serve on a board for the Provision Ministries, which is a ministry of the Christian Church. It was really started the way it was explained to me. It was back years ago when the Christian Church was flourishing, just like Churches of Christ were flourishing. And they would start to have people gather and they would want to build a building. And they would go to the bank and they'd say, we'd like to borrow money to build a building. And they said, no, we don't have this or that. So the Christian church leaders pooled their money, started a fund called the Church Development Fund. And they now have hundreds of millions of dollars that's in the Church Development Fund, whereby they help their churches build. However, that has just become one part of Provision Ministries. They really take and look at the whole life cycle of the church, from the beginning of the church planting to the furnishing of the building and how we theologically look at building the church. What does God really say and look at? To just the care of worship ministers and replacement service. On around to where we're going to talk today and spend our time. One of the ministries that I have been absolutely just taken by, that I think they're doing a very, very good job and way ahead of acapella churches, is in helping churches die well, I guess is the best way to say it. If you think about what's happening in America right now, we have got billions of dollars tied up in hardware, if you will, in bricks and mortar in our buildings. It was about 1974 when Tony Campolo, a sociologist from Eastern University, was sitting at my dinner table, and I remember him saying, Christians in America are going to have to answer to God for the billions of dollars we put into bricks and mortar when we have 100 children. And he said, someday it will come that God will call us to accountability for that, and it will all happen. I don't want to pretend to know again what God is doing, but could we be in a time where God is saying to us in this next generation, as they give up the institutional church and they move into suburbs and they move into home church, and it's happening all across America, that the billions of dollars we have got locked in over here, they're going to change hands. And what the Kairos Ministry of Provision is about is protecting those assets and moving them and keeping them into the hands of believers and keeping them out of the hands of non-believers so that we can go ahead and fulfill the ministry to which God has called us to. Churches of Christ, acapella churches, are prime for what we're calling steeplejacking. Think about it. We have no national organization. We have no denominational headquarters protecting us. Many of our churches are being led by older men wanting to hold on to the garden, and so vulnerable to movements. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and this is a true story. This is how bad it can get. I've never heard one worse. Downtown Nashville, Tennessee, there's a church. At the time, there was about a 2,000-member church going on, Central Church of Christ, Nashville, in the Belt Buckle, the Bible Belt, if you will. That church has been built down to about 40 people. They have two elders, both of 85 plus years old. They have one city block downtown Nashville. And they have parking on that block. Across the street, they have another parking lot that they need for a while. The parking lot on their own property where the building is, the slots are diagonal. The parking places over in the adjacent parking lot park in straight on. There's plenty of parking for everybody that's coming to that church right now. Nashville's grown up crazy. Nashville has gone through unbelievable. We built a new huge convention center. And the mayor needed that property, the adjacent parking lot. He went to those two elders and he said, I will give you $23 million for your adjacent parking lot. And I don't even need to own it. All I want is a 99-year lease. The church should maintain the ownership of it. But I need to do it. I need it. And our brothers said, no. There was one woman in the church who didn't like parking. Either in the diagonal or the straight, whichever is over on the cross of the church. And I said, no. We've had mediators in, we've had evolution people in, we've had everything in the world. We didn't see this. And I said, no. That's a sad situation. But there's some really good things going on with churches that are seeing themselves dying, recognize what's going on in the church. For whatever reason, the story of God in that church is changing. And it doesn't need to be terrible. I chair the ethics committee for the largest hospitals in Nashville, Tennessee, the largest hospital in the Southeast. And we say with hospice work, and that was the reason for the title, with hospice work, what we really do is help people live well while they die. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I think David Pace is really doing with independent Christian churches or apostolic churches of Christ or instrumental churches of Christ, is he's helping this church live well while it dies. And for that reason, I really felt like he needed to come in. Because what we're seeing, and I've got examples of this too, but churches are dying. And then what happens is a group of non-believers will go into the church, get involved in the church, get on the right committees of the church. Within 2 or 3 years, they have the power. They sell the building. They walk away. Smoke the money. And all of a sudden, assets that could have been used to feed the hungry or take care of the work that's going to go on in the hands of believers is now in the hands of non-believers. Brandy and I were in Edinburgh last year with a group of students, and it's amazing on that Royal Mile. The five cathedrals that are on that Royal Mile in Edinburgh, three of them now are bars. Bars. I wonder what happened. Did they really pay for those churches? Or was it hostile? I just think what happened, you know, that it's not negative to have a church change lives. Well, let's do it well. Let's protect the assets. Let's help them see that, you know, we're all living in God's story. And God's story changes from time to time. And it's fine if it's changing. But let's change well. And let's see that happen. David, come and help us. Let's just get started here. And you've got lots of things to show us. But talk to us for a minute about... What are the signs
that we need to call somebody like yourself? What do you see in a church that says, wake up?
Well, it's usually pretty apparent, even though people don't want to try to look at it. You see, first, of course, attendance declining. Now, that may be because of leadership issues within the church. It may be because the young people who grew up in that church are moving away to a college someplace else and not coming back into that area. Sometimes if it was an Anglo church in a suburb and there's been a demographic change in the neighborhood around it, then there's no ministry taking place from that location into the immediate neighborhood around it, that the few people who are there are just driving in. And so you have to do an analysis of a church and see who is it that's still attending, why are they attending, what ministry are they carrying into the community, and what's like the average age of the group too, which will tell you a lot about the future of that church.
Okay, but before you even go in and do that analysis, you're sitting in the pew of the church, and how do you know it's time to call hospitals?
What's the focus of the church? Are you spending your time and your energy reaching out into the community and serving the community and sharing the gospel? Or have you become a holy cub, just trying to protect what you've got?
Oh, you ever been part of a holy huddle? I know it. Been there. Good deal. Tell us what to do.
I actually went to a church last year where, when I walked up the front door, there was a sign on the front door. True story. And the sign said, "No assistance provided at this location." On the front door of the church, no assistance. So when I met with the leaders and we started analyzing what was going on inside the church, I just quite like asking, if we look at your expenses last year, how much did you spend in benevolent outreach into your community? What are your programs for outreach? How much were you ministering to the people that live within a 5-mile radius of the church? And they all were kind of chagrined when the treasurer said, zero. Not one penny was spent. And I looked at him and said, well, I already knew that because you have a sign on your front door that says no assistance is provided at this location. So actually, I did bring some resources with it. If you'd be welcome to, first of all, you're welcome to have a couple of brochures up here about our ministry afterwards. Feel free to take one of those, please. And then I brought some books. If you take it, I'll replace it, but we'll prefer you just find them and then order your own. But one of them is written by Tom Rayner down at Lifeway Christian Resources, and it's called The Autopsy of a Deceased Church. And so, to answer your question, what are some of the signs that should tell us what's going on? This is a great resource to do that. Well, let me talk with you real quickly, because we want to save some time for questions and answers, about legacy ministry. As Ron said, my name is David Pace. I graduated from Cincinnati Christian University and have spent a little more than the last 40 years in ministry as a missionary, as a local church pastor, as a leader of a church financing organization, and then for the last 5 years as a team leader for our Kairos Legacy Partners. What I want to do today is just challenge you with a couple of thoughts. One, there's a promise that we know and we claim that Jesus made, and that promise is in Matthew 16:18. For Jesus said, in response to Peter's confession, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." Right? We know that's true, and we count on it. And as evidence of the truth of that, we saw the church was established. Within a very few years, it turned the world, the then-known world, upside down. And we live in the confidence of that promise that Jesus is going to return and he will take us back to be with him eternally. So that's the church. That's a promise that we have about the church. Now, the problem that I have about that promise and how it's interpreted by churches today is this. Some well-intentioned church leaders believe that that promise of eternal life for the church is for their specific local congregation. And I don't believe that's what Jesus was talking about. So they view the closure of any local congregation as a failure or as unchristian. What they fail to remember is all of the good that was done there, the babies that were born there, the young people, the lives that were changed, the youth group activities, the weddings, the funerals, the baptisms, the Timothys that were sent out into ministry, or the missions that were supported. When a church is nearing the end of its life cycle, it finds it very difficult to reflect affectionately back on all the good that was done. They spend their time worrying about who's going to turn out the lights and what color are we going to paint the bathrooms and things like that. And so I try to lead them to ask themselves a question. If closing a church, a local church, truly is a failure, then every church that was established by the apostles in the first century was a failure. Because there's not one of those local congregations that's still in existence today. So Christ's promise was not about a local church. It was about the church. And I have no doubt that his promise is true. What I want to talk to you about is legacy, because what those first century churches did establish when they went off the scene was a legacy of their faithfulness to the people that they served, a passion, certainly, to send out missionaries to share the gospel. They were faithful of what Jesus said, starting in Jerusalem, then to Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the world. Well, they were faithful in carrying out and living with that passion. And then they were committed to make sure that the gospel was passed on generation after generation after generation. That's what we talk about when we talk about establishing a church's legacy. Here's some statistics that you might not be familiar with about the church here in the United States. According to the Barna research folks, or to the Lifeway research folks, there are somewhere around 400,000 evangelical or Christian churches in the United States. According to their studies, 80% of those are either plateaued, they've had no growth in the last several years, or they are in some level of decline. And some of them, very serious decline. One half of all of the churches in the United States today are small churches, running less than 100 people in their Sunday worship services. Now, we hear about the mega churches, and we see some churches that thrive. But statistically, when you look at churches all across the country, in the city, in the suburbs, out in the rural lands and farmlands, half of all the churches in the United States are small churches. And most shocking of all, somewhere between 1% and 2% of those churches will close their doors and call it quits this year, and year again next year, and again and again. So there are a large number of churches that are coming to the end of their life cycle. Now, as Rhonda mentioned earlier, that if you just do a little bit of mathematical computation, it doesn't take very long to figure that we have at least $1 billion of land and buildings owned by these declining and dying churches. That $1 billion is at risk, again, year after year after year. And in my mind, one of the biggest challenges that we face are not those facts, because those are just facts. I can prove those statistics. The challenge is changing the mindset of some dear, godly church leaders, but who have said in their mind, and they will say this over and over again, this church will not close on my watch. Like, that is a badge of honor. And I love the church. My father was a pastor. I'm a pastor. I love the church of Jesus Christ. But I also know that we're called to have some financial responsibility. Jesus taught us about parables of talents, that the talents were sent out and they had to be multiplied and returned. The talents that weren't used properly, there was condemnation to that servant. And so I'm very worried about our church leaders who have a mindset that they're doing the honorable thing by hanging on until the very last person in their church dies, or there's no one left to pay the electricity bill, and they think that's a badge of honor. when in reality there are millions of dollars, billions of dollars of kingdom assets that are at risk. When Rhonda told me the story about that church in Nashville, I immediately told her, for $23 million, I will move to Nashville. I will buy a black limousine. And I will pick up that dear sweet lady, and I'll drive her to the front door of the church every Sunday, and I'll drive her home. If that $23 million could be used to plant new churches and do missions. But, I mean, that's just typical of a mindset. I'm not going to close this church on my watch. And so, the biggest obstacle that we have is casting the vision for what could be done with kingdom resources if people were just willing to be open-minded. Well, quickly, let me tell you, we have three initiatives that we've established at Kairos Legacy Partners to work with in this area. The first one is to protect these declining churches and their assets from what Rhonda mentioned as steeplejacking. So we have established a church trust program. Now, it came about because these small independent churches, whether they're instrumental Christian churches or a cappella churches of Christ, because we have no denominational structure, because we are all autonomous, self-governed, if we have a small group, that small group can be led away and can be taken advantage of very easily. In fact, as Ron said, it's been given a name in the United States now. It's a strategy. You've heard of carjacking. Well, there are groups that are looking for to take over buildings, and they actually call it steeplejacking. It can happen by an internal coup where just one person, usually a dynamic, a real strong-willed person, becomes a member of that small church, and over a period of time, they end up running off some of the other people, and all of a sudden, they're the ones that can say, here's what we're going to do with this building, and all of a sudden, we've lost it for the sake of the kingdom. Or it can happen by an external, actual takeover, where a group will start having people move in. Maybe a couple this month, place their membership. A couple next month, place their membership. And it doesn't take very long before there's more of the new folks than there are of the old folks. And the bylaws can be voted out with a two-week notice typically. And all of a sudden, we've lost a very valuable piece of property for Christ's kingdom. So our trust program is designed to protect against that. And that the church actually transfers their property into a trust. It says that church has to remain its heritage. It can't be turned into some other type of church. And in that trust document, the leaders of the church today designate what they want done with their assets if the day comes, whether it's 6 months down the road or 6 years down the road. If they close, they've already put into their will, so to speak, what's going to happen to their assets. Here's an example of that. Cortez Christian Church in Colorado. I used to live in the Denver, Colorado area, spent a lot of time with these churches, and one day they called me and asked me to come down and meet with them. They were down to a group of about 20 people. They weren't ready to close yet. They were still struggling with the emotions. But they were afraid that another group in town was going to find a way to take over their property. So they put their property in trust. They continued for about 2 years meeting and trying to revive themselves and get back on their feet. But they simply weren't able to do so. And so in their trust document, they had named their local church camp, they had named the church planting organization, and the our benevolence fund to be recipients of their assets. And so they just made a telephone call to us, sent us a letter, they had a vote to close, and we were able to step right in as a trustee, liquidate that property, and make sure that the assets went into those ministries. Interesting story. We've heard that church buildings are hard to sell, and many times they are. But in our experience, God's really blessed us, and with this little building in a small town in southwestern Colorado, we had it on the market for less than a month, and on the same day, we had three different buyers come to the table, one to buy it, and so we actually got a bidding war started. And so the kingdom got more money than what the building was actually probably worth. So, great story for Cortez. So, church trusts. That's for churches that aren't ready to die today, but want to write their will for the future. Legacy churches. This is for churches that are ready to close. They're tired, they're worn out, it's time to call it quits. And I want to tell you a story of a church here locally, First Christian Church of Santa Ana, California. They were a mega church back in the 1970s and 1980s, so they were running anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000. Well, this is one of those stories where the demographics around the church transitioned dramatically. And this church tried. They hired staff members. They did everything they could think of to stay up with the changing demographics. But the reality was they weren't able to. And so by the year 2000, they had declined down to just a handful. That's a large building. That building will seat about 700 or 800 in the sanctuary. They had parking and other fellowship halls and gymnasiums. By the end of the time, they were meeting in a fireside chapel room. They couldn't even afford to have utilities on in the rest of the buildings. But they were very concerned that their assets be used for the furtherance of Christ's kingdom. And so, when they made this decision to become a legacy church, they donated their land and their buildings. We were able to sell it for a little over $5 million. $1 million was given to one of our local colleges, and then $3.6 million was used to establish what we call the Church Planting Fund. Through that Church Planting Fund, in the last 12 years, since 2003 when this happened, more than 350 new churches have been established with partnerships that have received some or all of their funding through this Church Planting Fund. Now, that little group of 40 people had the vision to see that they could be a seed and what that could do to bear great fruit. Remember in John 12, Jesus said, if a seed remains, it doesn't fall to the earth and die, it's just a seed. But if it does die, it can bear great fruit. Well, this is a classic example of that. Now, other churches have seen that model happen, and the churches themselves and individuals have donated either their land and buildings or cash, and that church planting fund has grown in the last 12 years from $3.6 million over $14 million.
What's the acronym, CPF?
Church Planting Fund. Church Planting Fund. That money, that $14 million, is in an endowment account with Church Development Fund that Rhonda was telling you about. It is loaned out to churches to buy land and build their church buildings, the growing churches, and the interest on that money then is donated for church planting. So it's truly putting kingdom resources back to work for kingdom purposes. Our third initiative is what we call honoring a legacy. Now, we're all very familiar with the passage in Matthew 25, where Jesus was teaching about caring for the needy. And so we understood when he talked to his disciples about seeing those who are hungry or thirsty and taking care of their physical needs. And by and large, our churches have done a good job at reaching out into their community and being the hands and feet of Jesus in that compassionate way. But what about our aging ministers and ministry and missionaries who have been the ones doing the caregiving? What happens when they become retirement age or older? So we established as part of our legacy program the Kairos Benevolence Fund. And our purpose is to provide compassion and care for our aging ministers and missionaries, these who have faithfully served God for so many years. You know, many of them lived in parsonages all their life. They never owned a home. Many of them served for embarrassingly low wages over the years. They were not offered benefits like health insurance or disability or retirement plans or savings. And so there is no safety net in our Christian Church Restoration Movement Brotherhood for our aging ministers and missionaries. If they face some kind of a health crisis or some kind of a financial crisis, they're on their own. Hopefully they have families to help them, but we don't have an actual program in place. So we established the Kairos Benevolence Fund. And that's what this one brochure here, the blue brochure, will tell you all about. It relies on donations into the Benevolence Fund. And then when we hear of ministers and missionaries that have a specific need, we pay the bills to meet those needs. We don't get out cash. We're not like a social security system. But we pay the bill to meet that specific need. So we had some fun. Now, I don't think Jesus would mind if we wrote Matthew 25 according to 21st century situations. So, here's our version of Matthew 25. I needed dental surgery. They had no money to pay. Their teeth were rotting. And we paid for root canal. This pastor was about to lose his home, so we paid a mortgage payment. This faithful servant had had a heart attack. And insurance had paid for some of the doctor and hospital bills, but they needed therapy beyond that to recover the use of an arm, and we paid for that therapy. This pastor's wife, my husband, died while we were living in the parsonage. Well, they had to give the parsonage back. She had no place to move, and so we rented an apartment for her. Recently, we had one elderly gentleman. His hearing aids were broken. He didn't have enough money to repair his hearing aids. We took care of repairing the hearing aids. And then an 87-year-old missionary couple, still on the field in Kenya, had to have surgery. There was just all kinds of complications. But then they were on their way driving to a baptismal service, and someone rear-ended them, and they had no way to have their car repaired. They couldn't afford to have the car repaired. Now, there's actually more to the story. I've got to tell you real quick. They left the scene of the accident. The police pulled up, and this missionary gets out and goes, "You guys take care of the problem with the car. I've got someone waiting to be baptized." He hooked it at 87 years old onto the church and took care of the baptism, and then came back, and then we took care of his car. So, you know, God's servants are amazing. And the biggest problem we have with the benevolent son is getting people to tell us they have a need. So many of our ministers and missionaries are accustomed to sacrificing, and they just don't think it's right for them to tell you they've got a need. So we put the word out everywhere we go. If you know a minister or a missionary that is facing a specific crisis where we can pay the bill for them, you let us know about it. We want to try to do that. So that's the ministry that Rhonda has mentioned to you that we're involved in. Kairos Financing Partners. We're trying to raise the legacy awareness across the country, just like Hospice Care has done, to provide that quality of care they do for individuals to help them live while they're dying. We want to help churches live while they're dying, but be realistic and make sure that those kingdom assets are paid forward so that we carry out the Great Commission of the Gospel. Now, one more quick slide. Rhonda mentioned to you the ministry that we're affiliated with. This is a quick slide about our Provision Ministry Group. That's our parent organization up there based down in Irvine. And so, as we have added ministries to our family, we've done so to try to support the local church, we say, from launch all the way to legacy. And so our church planting group is called Stadia Church Planters. They help start new churches. Then you have Visionary Studios, which is an architectural and a design build firm. Here's Church Development Fund. They're the financial arm that make the loans available to the churches. The Co-Vision Foundation is a donor-advised fund that will help high-net-worth people carry out their philanthropy for the sake of the kingdom. The Slingshot Group are group of guys that work on helping to find the right senior minister or worship minister for our church. They don't want to be called headhunters because they don't go after preachers. But if they hear of a church that has a need, and they know of someone who is available, and they try to match them up. And then they also do staff coaching along that line. And then you have Kairos here completing the end of the circle of life as we take those declining church resources and redeploy them back into the kingdom service of, again, new churches and missions and support like that around the globe. So thank you for letting me tell you about Kairos, Rhonda.
How do you see this working in independent acapella churches? It seems more weird. To me, it seems like every church should have something like that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a question.
Okay.
Kairos said at one time Kairos would go and meet with the church and actually give them information about the demographics that now exist in their neighborhood. and kind of let them know how that matches up or doesn't match up.
Yes,
and
we do have a ministry analysis service where if the church wants to have us do a health checkup for them, we will come in and we will create a survey for their congregation, asking specific questions about their congregation. At the same time, we'll also do a demographic and ethnographic study of their community. And then we'll come back and we'll bring in a report. And we'll say, here's what you show as your talents and your interests, and here's what's going on in your community, and here's what you would need to do if you were going to go to reach out to your community. That church I mentioned earlier that had a sign on the door, we did an analysis for them. And we learned that out of their 40 or 50 people who were still attending, almost all of them were driving 15 miles into the church and 15 miles back out. And there was nothing taking place in here. Well, this was a different ethnicity. And so if they were going to really reach that area, they would have to change the way they did church. And I'm sorry to say, they're not willing to make a change. And so we have proposed several solutions to them. They've got an asset. But the bottom line is they're going to sit there until they can't pay the bill, and they're not going to touch that community.
Yes.
Can I just follow up on what you just said?
Sure.
But, I mean, I'm struggling to wrap my head around. I kind of represent what I would say the new generation of Church of Christ leadership. I'm on the leadership team of our church here at Oracle. And I'll tell you this, your story in Nashville breaks my heart. What I'm trying to wrap my head around is, you know, we've got a leadership team in our churches, infinite, that's caused the church to get to that stage. Mm-hmm. And now we're trying to convince them to make a drastic change when they can't wrap their arm around the why they are down to 40 versus the 500 they were maybe a decade or two ago. How is your success of, I mean, is telling the story in this manner successful? I just think there's something to that story that I'm trying to get around.
Well, our experience is every declining church has a different history and a different situation. And that's why this analysis that we can do helps us to understand how did they get to where they are today. And it also helps us identify, are there resources within the church, or could there be resources brought to bear that would help them to revitalize and get back on their feet? In this situation I mentioned, we talked to the church leaders at great length. We showed them what the ethnicities around them are looking for, and there are resources that would help to do an ethnic ministry. But those people are not interested, not willing, will not accept the help to do what needs to be done to reach that community. And so the best thing that can happen is for them to actually just pick up and go to a different area and let us take that building, and maybe it has to be sold in order to get the value out of it, but then let's bring in ministry of a color into that community and really reach them. So we don't go in with a canned solution to their problem. We go in and try to understand where did they come from, how did they get there. If they can be revitalized, we want to help bring those resources together. At some point, though, it's time to be honest and admit they're not going to make it. And they're sitting on all these resources, and we hope we can cast a vision that they will let those resources be used in other kingdom ways. Our independence, our autonomy, and whether you're an instrumental church or an acapella, our autonomy is one of our greatest strengths. And it's also one of our greatest weaknesses.
It seems to me that this almost needs to happen, the roots of this needs to happen when a church is healthy and growing. I mean, you can have a conversation of, should this happen down the road for our grandchildren, right? And theoretically have that. But go ahead and put it in place of how those resources will be protected, God forbid it happens. that's an easier conversation. You know, Randy and I worked for 20 years in church conflict. And he said, you know, they never call until the tomato is too ripe. You know, if they would have called just back there when it was just a great time for slicing and partaking, we could have helped them. But they wait until it's too late. And I think that's what's going on here so many times. I mean, how many of you know what would happen to your church? I mean, is it in your bylaws? Is it in your deed? Of what will happen to the resources of prayer and worship right now? Many of us don't even know. We've never thought of that.
And if you haven't had an analysis done, just because you have something in your bylaws, that's only a minimal first step. A good attorney can come in and counsel somebody, and they can change your bylaws just almost like that. That's why the trust has been proven. There was actually a church here in L.A. That was in trust, and CDF defended that trust in 7 different court hearings. It went all the way to the steps of the California State Supreme Court before it was finally ruled, trust cannot be broken. This has to remain a Christian church. And so this other group, the kind of sequel jacket, finally had to give up and go away. So, you know, bylaws aren't enough by themselves. And maybe, you know, having a conditional deed may be another step that helps protect that. But we've got to be open to various ways, and we sort of know the trust is the way it works.
You know, I've always watched these reality shows with this chef that goes into a restaurant that's running out of business because the food is not good, because the management, and I've always thought this has to be done in the church for churches that are stuck. Yeah. And, you know, of course, the commodity is not food or the climate they'll hear, you know, it's the gospel and it's the Christians, and, you know, eternity is at stake. And my question is, do you go to other countries? Because we're stuck in Greece. I'm from Greece.
Would you be willing to go to Athens?
Athens,
Greece.
Athens, Texas.
How quickly can I say yes? I'd love to visit Athens, Greece.
Yeah.
Actually, David is too busy. I think.
Yes. We'd like to talk to you later today. I think we're having some kind of a gathering where we're saying, seriously, we're going to talk about it.
I went through this about 12 years ago at one of those little struggling 20-member churches come and say, you're a larger church, can you bring speakers, can you do this and everything? There were 3 primary couples, and I visited up there, and the 3 couples couldn't even get together with themselves and get that done. And I finally looked at them and said, there's not going to be any help coming. And it was kind of like I had said that the gospel no longer functioned, because that becomes the DNA. I really appreciate your point about the idea that churches are going to come and go. Locations will come and go, though the church will never go anywhere. So I lived that. That was not a pleasant conversation. I lost some friends. They don't want to hear it.
And that is our challenge about trying to get this message to healthy churches. Right? I couldn't agree more. A healthy church should be very concerned about protecting their assets, and they should do everything they can. Be forward-looking enough to say, we know that everything has a life cycle. So let's not be afraid of it. Let's invest into the future. Well, that's also a difficult conversation to have.
Dan, are you exclusively
invested
in the Christian church, or do you...
No, when we were founded, we very clearly specified that we could help churches, whether they were instrumental Christian churches, whether they were acapella churches in Christ. There's another group that's very similar to us, Church of God, I imagine, in Indiana, theologically. You know, they're very close, and we have a relationship with that. So we'll work with various churches.
Yes. And is there a charge for your assessment?
It depends on what the church wants us to do. That analysis we were talking about a little bit ago, that is a fee-based service. We do charge a fee to do that consulting service. If a church is going to put their property in trust, or if they are ready to close, we don't charge a specific fee. We ask that church to simply include either Kairos or the Benevolence Fund or the Church Planting Fund as one of the beneficiaries. And that way, then, we know that we're providing dialogue service and they're helping us to continue on this.
I'd like to ask what is it about bylaws that could be vulnerable? Help me understand a little
bit
about that.
Sure. Typically, bylaws require a majority or a certain number of majority of the voting members in order to change the bylaws. Okay, and in our experience, churches are all over the place with who the members are. Members can be as young as 14. I think we've seen as young as 14. And so let's just say that you have 20 members left in your church. And over a period of several months, friends come, other people come, join, and become members of your church. And now there's 40 of them and 20 of you. They call for a vote according to your bylaws, and they can outvote those of you who were there originally. So it's not uncommon for them to actually look at your bylaws and to do a legal maneuver according to your bylaws.
Okay. I guess I'm wondering, what is the remedy for that? What can you do?
A church trust solves that problem because the property is placed into the trust. It is an irrevocable trust. It cannot be broken. And in that trust, it specifies that this property is to remain a Church of Christ as long as it functions. And if it ceases to function, if it closes, then the property is to be sold and the money distributed to the ministries that you've named, you specify. Like a family trust.
Exactly. It's nothing more than a last will and testament. I'm sure.
But I'm thinking in terms of Minnesota, where we have a nonprofit we have a statute here that makes it legal to establish a nonprofit corporation, and there are rules there that have to do with the disbursement of the assets of such an organization if it becomes defunct. And would you be saying then that that is not adequate protection for?
Sure, because the IRS, what you're talking about here, is corporation law. It says that the assets of a 501c3, a nonprofit, have to go to another nonprofit if this church closes. Well, the Red Cross is a nonprofit. The Humane Societies are nonprofits. There are a lot of other nonprofits that they may be good nonprofits, but they're not your church. And so if a group came in and took over your church, you wouldn't want to donate your church building to some other nonprofit. That's why naming specific ministries in a trust protects against something happening to your resources that you wouldn't approve of.
Yeah, Paige? The problem is a little more subtle than that, however, because federal law and state laws with regard to the type of closures you're talking about have to do with the dissolution of the corporation normally. If the corporation becomes defunct and there's no other plan for the distribution of the property, then those laws kick in to cover how it gets distributed. But I'm sure many of you are part of the church that borrow money and build a building, or maybe you build it on your own or raise the money to build it, and you sold that building and then build another one. There's nothing to prohibit those kinds of transactions in the life of the church. And the reason those laws don't kick in is because you haven't dissolved the corporation. What a takeover group can do, whether they need to change the bylaws or not, is come in and vote to sell the property. They keep the corporation alive. And because the corporation is not dissolved, there's no laws that govern the distribution of the property. And then once the assets are gone, then the corporation can close or not. And at that point, when the dissolution clause in the bylaws or the articles of incorporation kick in, there's no assets left to distribute. And so, that, frankly, I've got an article up on our website that simply said bylaws are pretty much useless with regard to protecting your church from any kind of a takeover or internal coup like they would.
These two fine friends who are meeting us this morning to help us, and I really do appreciate them coming very, very much. I've said it here before, and I want to just leave you with this thought. You know, so many times we get in crisis, and our question is, why is this happening to me? What did I do to deserve this? What is God wanting me to do? And we just stop. When we change the question, we get out of the way ourselves and ask, what is God doing? It totally changes the possibility of thinking who you give us. In the life of the church, you get to the end of the road, you get in a crisis. And let's not ask the question of, or come back with the answer of, this will not happen on my watch. Question is, what is God doing? It's His story. He knows His church is going to live forever. So let's get the right questions together. Thank you for being here. Blessings on your journey.